After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
To be successful in business, you have to have values. You have to stand by those values. And you can't compromise those values, but you also have to have the tools to do that. So what do I mean by that? Well, it's what you've been teaching me all these years. It's, you know, you have to, I mean, whether it's meditation or other forms of self-exploration, you have to have a way to shed the stress and to really dive into what's important.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Heart Wisdom here on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. I'm Ganesh Braymiller, here to introduce Jack Kornfield, along with his guest, the executive chairman of the Ford Motor Company, Bill Ford. I did not expect this to be Jack's podcast guest this time around, but Jack always surprises me with the amount of people he knows in different scenes, and I think that's something really special about Jack, that very much like Ram Dass with his social venture capitalist network, Jack was okay talking with the hippies in the 60s. He is okay also sitting down with highly professional businessmen and shedding his light into a sector that probably doesn't have as much consciousness as the general populace listening to Heart Wisdom, let's say. And that's not to say that there isn't conscious business. That's just to say the way the system is set up right now is very much take everything that you can get, not caring so much about who you're stepping on to get there. So it's really cool, actually, to hear what the executive chairman of Ford, Bill Ford, has to share about his relationship with meditation and mindfulness and values and the next generation. It was surprising to me, and I hope it's surprising to you as well. And I have to let you know that this conversation was originally recorded for the Inner MBA program presented by Sounds True. So before diving into this amazing content, I do want to let you know this is maybe your last chance to sign up for Jack's new Stories course, at least for the on-demand live version, where you'll have the opportunity to be in online Sangha with Jack twice throughout the course. So this is Transform Your Life through Jack Kornfield's Most Powerful Stories, a 10-hour journey. And it's Jack's hand-picked favorite stories from his teaching career that are meant to transform the mind and open the heart. If you sign up before September 28th, you will receive 2 live question and answer sessions with Jack and the student body to go into the themes of the stories, and also just to be able to be in Sangha around this very unique and cool offering. And I would also like to inform you that Jack will be back with his Monday Night Dharma Talk for Spirit Rock on October 16th. That will be online. And there's also another amazing Spirit Rock offering he's giving with his beloved Trudy Goodman, who I'm sure you know well. This is called Loving Presence, Compassion, and a Joyful Heart, and it takes place on November 4th. Again, it's online and in support of Spirit Rock. So there we are. I just wanted to thank you so much for always showing up and always offering your divine and kind attention here. And I would like to now open the door to Jack Kornfield and Bill Ford in this amazing podcast, Heart Wisdom, Episode 206, Capitalism, Right Livelihood, and the Next Generation. May you be well. May you be happy. May you help others through the authenticity of your own being. And may your heart smile. Namaste, y'all.
It is a real pleasure to sit here with Bill. We've been friends for a dozen years or longer.
Longer.
Maybe. And we, well, I'll tell you about him and then how we met. No, I'll go backwards. We met because I got a contact from Bill. He'd been listening, a student of meditation and mindfulness, and listening to talks that I gave or reading things. And then he contacted me at one point, and it was back in 2008. When the economy was melting down, and you said, you know, it was possible that you would lose your grandfather's company and the entire industry on your watch. And in fact, Ford was the only major company that had the foresight to actually put money in the bank, to borrow a lot of money so that you didn't have to get the government to bail you out.
Right.
So you were saying, you know, this makes a little wee bit of stress. It's light and trouble sleeping. What you got? Is there anything that can help? And we started this conversation about what meditation practices would do. But then as I got to know you, what I understood is that you've been, I'll call it a servant leader, for decades. And to me, what that means is that your role as a leader has been to look for what's the best good that you can offer to the people in the company, the people it serves, and to the world. And that meant, among other things, that you were one of the earliest major figures in industry to stand up for the climate. We'll just use that as an example and say we really have to pay attention to what's happening to the climate. And what happened is you got attacked and slammed for a good 10 or 20 years or more. Not a small thing. This is kind of an amazing thing to know and have that sense of integrity that I know this is important and these are my values. And in some way, people at Ford love this man because they trust your values. They know you worked on the assembly line and I know what you care for. That's the whole game in some way.
Well, thank you, Jack. Thank you very much. And I guess it's my turn to introduce Jack, right? Who needs no introduction. But, I won't do it justice, so I won't even try. But Jack is, as you all know, probably the leading American Buddhist and also scholar. But much more than that, he's someone who's touched people's lives all around the world. Famous people, young people, people with horrific problems, people with they can't get out of their own head. I mean, Jack has touched every one of those and really many, many of them. But what's most remarkable about Jack is he's also very much in the moment. You can talk to Jack about the NFL game that happened yesterday. You can talk to Jack about, what's new in music. And then very easily go right into some very deep conversations about inner exploration, Buddhism, mindfulness, and all those things. And so he's just a remarkable person. And as Jack said, we've become good friends over the years. And actually, Jack, I probably the only time I've ever corrected you. It was when I read your book, A Path with Heart, and I called up, I love the book so much that I called information in, because it said the author lives in Woodacre, California. And I called the information. I said, hey, do you have a Jack Kornfield? And they said, yes, we do. So I called you. And then I came
so
up.
So old fashioned. I love it.
Well, this is before Google searches and everything. And so this is many years ago. And so I went up to Spirit Rock and met Jack and then we've become, I really admired him. And then from that point on, we started to deepen our relationship and deepen the work we've done together. And I must say, I've been running Ford for 25 years now. And there have been some just, really, really ugly times. And Jack, one thing he always told me was, I know you want to take care of everyone else, but if you don't take care of yourself first, you're not going to be doing anybody else any good. And that really was so important to me because I was so frazzled and didn't have any way to manage it. And you gave me those tools, and it wasn't just meditation. It was the questions you asked. It was the kind of the things you made me think about. And by the way, it's been a lot of fun too.
What does someone need who's in the business world? Here we're talking about the inner MBA, you know, and you are a guest lecturer at MIT or at Wharton and so forth. Mm-hmm. And noticing that people in the old days, it was just, let's get our education, let's get the economics, let's do our case studies, let's run a business. And that doesn't work anymore for people. And I'll just say something kind of personal. So when I left Dartmouth College and I had a good Ivy League education, philosophy and mathematics and history, and I was doing pre-med, you know, lots of good science. And then I switched to Asian studies, which became my new industry, whatever, and went into the Buddhist monastery. I learned about forgiveness. No one taught me that. I learned how to deal with my own anger because my father was violent and I didn't know what to do with all that rage. I learned how to deal with my own longing and desires or fears. No one taught me any of that. My whole inner life, it was as if I had the second half of my education that was missing then. And now what you're saying is for business school or business leaders, there's a different education that's needed.
Well, there has to be. I mean, I think, you know, business is the easy stuff. And I must tell you that, you know, in all my time at top of Ford, if I were to think of all the most difficult things I've had to deal with, they're all people. And it's people, and it's wrestling with interpersonal relationships. It's wrestling with, you know, and rather than get angry at them, you have to try and understand them and where they're coming from, and you have to be empathetic. And when you do that, often what you get back is, no one's ever treated me like this. Mm. And that's a shame. But I do think that, you know, to be successful in business, you have to have values. You have to stand by those values. And you can't compromise those values, but you also have to have the tools to do that. So what do I mean by that? Well, it's what you've been teaching me all these years. It's, you know, you have to, I mean, whether it's meditation or other forms of self-exploration, you have to have a way to shed the stress and to really dive into what's important. So it's really a two-pronged thing. It's a set of values, but then it's also, for lack of a better term, a coping mechanism that people have to have. And ultimately, that will, I believe, result in much better interpersonal relationships, which all of business is really about. It just is. I mean, you know, people, it's not about return on investment or, you know, whether we launch this product or launch that product. I mean, that's the easy stuff. But it's all the other stuff that will give you the stamina to see it through. And I think you see so much burnout now, and particularly with MBA students, because there's great pressure on them. You know, often it's financial pressure. Often it's pressure from home to succeed. You know, and it's their own expectations of, you know, they're going to these schools and then they're told, well, now you need to go out and be great. And they're like, wait, how do I be great? What does that mean? And so I think that the business schools in general desperately need this kind of program. And most of them don't have it.
Yeah, I was invited to go to Stanford Business School some years ago by one of the assistant deans and by a senior faculty member to do an event for the entire student body on the very things that we're talking about, and particularly about well-being and vision and what matters to you. And so I said, well, I can't do that alone. And I called in some favors, which was the CEO of Monsanto at the time and the COO of, I think, Mattel. And so some pretty notable level business leaders, and Rachel Remen, who's a physician who's worked for years at Stanford and elsewhere to humanize medicine and medical curriculum. And so we did some meditations together, and people talked about the leaders talked about what they learned. And then these people, so smart, so good, who are all there, like at the top of their game, you know, they're the cream of the crop. And the dean had called me and he said, you know, the problem is that they come in and they're raring to go. And by the time they're ready to get in a corporation, they've lost something. And I said, well, what have they lost? He said, they don't know who they are. They've lost their values. I said, so you want something like soul retrieval? And the dean said, yeah, that's what we're looking for. It was a very funny conversation. So at the end, you know, the ones on stage would say, all right, I made $150 million. I wasn't happy. Somebody else raised their hand. You know, I made this. I wasn't that happy. And the look on the faces of people saying, well, what makes you happy? And that was a question. It wasn't that they didn't want to do good, and it wasn't that they didn't have a tremendous creative impulse, but they didn't know the human cost and the way to navigate it in some way.
And I would say, Jack, too, that if employees have that, and they also believe in the values that you set forth as a leader, it makes a much better company, a much stronger company, as well as stronger individuals. And I can give you a very vivid example. You referenced earlier the 2008, you know, the financial crisis, and you know, our two big competitors, General Motors and Chrysler, went bankrupt, and we were, you know, hanging on the very edge. And interesting time, because I got called to the White House and asked if we would take either GM or Chrysler, and I told President Obama, no, he wasn't very happy with me. But I said that because I said, you know, if it's too much, we'll go bankrupt too. If you're asking us to take on, you know, more obligations, you know. But anyway, you know, it was interesting what happened then, and this will always stick with me forever. Our employees simply wouldn't let us fail. And it didn't happen at GM and Chrysler. I was told it Friday night at 5 o'clock at GM and Chrysler, you know, you could shoot a cannon down the hall and not hit anybody. Our employees were working till midnight, 1 a.m. They were working all day Saturday, all day Sunday. They weren't sure they were going to have a job on Monday morning. They didn't get any overtime. But I was flooded with emails and letters from employees saying, hey, Bill, don't give up. We can do this. Now, those were from the factory floor. They were from people in lower management. They were, and I got hundreds and hundreds of them. And normally those messages are top down, but they were coming to me from, and it just showed me that the love that people had for our company and kind of what we stood for. And they pulled us through. I mean, they absolutely pulled us through. And as you point out, we didn't go bankrupt and we didn't take the bailout. And it was because of, I think, the way our employees felt about our company. And if I could just give you one more quick example, it was, okay, so now fast forward, COVID hits. And without even asking, our company stopped making cars. And immediately we started making gowns, respirators, masks, ventilators. And nobody asked for permission. Nobody asked what it was going to cost. And we just did it. And, you know, and I was so proud. And then somebody said, well, should we have asked you? I said, absolutely not. Because that shows that the values are actually being lived and believed, that, you know, when we're needed, we respond, and, you know, to whatever is needed at the time. And, you know, and so I think that if you have values and people understand them and they embrace them, and values are different than culture. Cultures change all the time inside companies. And culture is what's needed to deliver the business. So if you need to go faster, you need to be leaner, you need whatever it is, that can be part of your culture. But the values sit above that. And I think most companies don't either have it or don't talk about it. But we do, we talk about it a lot, and we encourage our employees to live it a lot. I started something called the Volunteer Corps, which allows all our employees around the world to go do whatever they want to do to help the world. It can be something small like, you know, help your local school, you know, with a playground, or it can be something like disaster relief in Turkey when the earthquake hits. The reason I wanted to do, that I did that was I noticed that whenever we had a sign up for some volunteer thing, not only were all the slots filled, but people were writing below it, hoping that they could. And I thought, well, okay, let's make this, let's institutionalize this. Let's not just, you know, ask to do it on ad hoc. But it's something that it's real, it's enduring, and people want to feel part of something that's more than a paycheck, or more than a stock option, or more than, you know, if it's just money, it's not good enough. And, you know, it's something that I hope we never lose.
So what you're talking about also resonates within Buddhist teaching, what's called right livelihood.
Yes.
Which is the livelihood that not only doesn't cause harm, but somehow uses the energy of your life, your incarnation, to bring benefit in four ways to yourself, to your community, to, you know, the environment around you, all those kind of things. So here's a, I'm going to up-level the question and make it harder, because you wrestle with hard questions. A lot of current capitalism doesn't have good social values. And doesn't have really guarding rules for it. I was looking at a book called Capitalism in a World on Fire by Rebecca Henderson from MIT and Harvard Business School. And it was basically what we know, saying that if you don't have built in, as you say, a lever of values, it will undermine the whole society. So how do you vision, this is a little bit like the bodhisattva intention, if you go to the sort of heart of it, if you take a bodhisattva vow, it's I will do the work or whatever I do, but my intention is to be of benefit, not just for myself, but in the weave that we share. What do you see about capitalism at this point?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, and I'll get to that in just a second, but, you know, corporations in general, I mean, as much as I like to believe, and I do believe, that Ford is a good company and dedicated to doing good things, I know somewhere right now, somewhere in the Ford world, that some bad thing is happening. And it just is. And so the question is not how do you ever prevent that from happening, but the question is how do you deal with it when you find it? And what are the set of expectations that you have for, you know, discovering bad behavior? And that bad behavior can take all kinds of different forms, right? I mean, it can be financial malfeasance. It can be personal bad behavior. It could be, you know, lying. I mean, it could be anything. And it happens. And it's because it's people, and people aren't perfect. And corporations certainly aren't perfect. But it is, okay, you must bring it to light, and you must deal with it, and you must deal with it in a way that people are satisfied with the way you deal with it. And I think that kind of gets to the question, which is if you do that and you do have values, you smooth the rough edges or off of capitalism in terms of the bad behavior, right? But we have morphed capitalism, I believe, into, and it happened really in the last 20 years, into a power grab and a greed grab that kind of didn't exist when I was younger. And maybe it did, but it wasn't celebrated. It's celebrated in the last 20 years. I mean, that really bothers me. It's, you know, how much money did you make, you know, and who did you have to step over to do it, you know, and it's, and I think that part of capitalism is terrible, and I don't want to pin it on Silicon Valley, because that wouldn't be fair, but I think it was exacerbated by a lot of the early success that happened in Silicon Valley, and the quick money and the stock options and the competitiveness that, you know, and it just, it really became our, you know, in some ways the American business ethos, which it shouldn't be. But so I don't think in capital, because When I look at other forms of economic activity, I still think the roots of capitalism are the best thing that we have. But it does require then society to build around it safety nets. It requires society to build compassion so that, you know, that the money made with capitalism is deployed in a thoughtful and kind manner. But, you know, when I look at other forms, you know, they all have big flaws too, and in some cases, bigger flaws. But I don't like what capitalism has become. And I'm hopeful that this next generation will pull us back from that. Because I think the values that a lot of the next generation have are much closer to maybe what the great generation, the post-World War II generation had in terms of being more selfless, less about me, and what I can get all the time.
Yeah, some of it's grown in these last decades. I've watched it too as an outsider, but the kind of economics that came from the University of Chicago and Milton Friedman and so forth, whereas the premise is your goal is to make as much money as possible. Yep. And it doesn't matter how you, more or less how you do it.
Right.
And then the outcome is that companies get destroyed or communities can get destroyed.
No question.
At the same time, the energy of uplifting people to say, you can make a difference. You can build a business or work for one and make some, that's tremendously empowering. So how do we navigate those? And part of it, as you said, is actually, it's not just a reform of capitalism, but it's the society's values. And that we have to actually say as a society, we will take care of our children.
Mm-hmm.
We will educate them in ways, you know, that are necessary that produce a beautiful future, in spite of the fact that it will cost everyone some money. And so somehow we have to relearn. And I was telling you in the meditation retreats that I teach, one of the good things is that the youngest generation who come don't want to learn meditation as an interior practice alone. Okay, I can manage my stress. I can forgive what I need to. I can live with more, you know, loving kindness and so forth. They don't want to do it unless it's also connected with, will this help with the climate crisis?
Mm-hmm.
Will this help with continuing racism? Can I learn something that's not apart from the world, but that actually these are weighing on my heart, and I want to learn how to do both in some way? And so you're sort of positing that, but I haven't seen it. I'm hoping you're right about the next generation.
Well, I think you just said it, though. They are asking those questions, which prior generations weren't asking. And I think that's very hopeful, that if they can have the inner journey and connect it to some greater societal need, that's wonderful. I mean, if that is the way the next generation is coming at it, it's very different. And to me, that gives me a lot of hope.
Do you see that at Ford? Is there a new generation coming saying, we want the company to succeed and we really want to be a force for good in the world somehow?
Yes, but I don't think that's just generational. I actually think everybody wants that. Not just at Ford, I think everybody wants to feel like they belong to something that is greater than themselves, that stands for something that they're proud of. But what I think is different is the younger generation want to be involved now. They don't, it's like, okay, I get it. Now tell me what I can do and how I can do it. And we have to, you know, so we spend a lot of time figuring out how do we enable them to go do these things. It was really interesting. We had I also have this group called 30 Under 30 that I put together with 30 employees under the age of 30. And I spent a year with them teaching them kind of, for lack of a better word, how to be a philanthropist. How do you do things in the community that make a difference? Well, it was really interesting because the first class, I brought them to like the traditional things like United Way and, you know, Salvation Army and all those older groups. And when I say older, I mean old, they've been long established. But interestingly, these young people, at the end, they all present to me and they have the sponsoring organization with them too. And it was really interesting when the Salvation Army people and the young people came, that every group, whether it was United Way, Salvation Army, and all the others, said, we learned way more from them than they learned from us. Mm. And by the way, we're having to change our entire model because our average volunteer is 68 years old, and we're going to be out of business in 10 years if that continues. And so we are, these young people have taught us that we are completely out of touch. Even though our mission was good, it's not enough. We need, and what we really need to do is create a sense of community, which we haven't done. And so it really, to me, it was fascinating, that very first class that we did with those 30 under 30, because it showed me that the young people have so much to offer, but they're not interested in joining in a traditional way a group like United Way or Salvation Army, unless they can radically change it.
So one of the things that you do, and that I also spend a lot of time doing, is mentoring other people. You mentor the leaders at Ford, and then the ones under them, or even the 30 under 30. And you're really interested in some way in how do you, if you're a leader and you're doing an inner MBA and you want to get in business, it's not only, how do you lead well, but how do you bring the best out of other people? It's one of the things that I've learned to do and love doing, because I look at them and I see this person has some gifts. My old friend Maladoma Somme, who was a West African shaman, medicine man who had a couple of PhDs from the Sorbonne and I think from Michigan, said that in the Dogara people, we believe that every child who's born carries a certain cargo. And I love this metaphor because cargo, it's like the cargo ships that ply the rivers in West Africa. And their job on Earth is to deliver their cargo, deliver the particular gift that was given to them. Mm-hmm. So when I mentor people, as much as asking what they're interested in or how they're doing it, I'll have them close their eyes and say, visualize yourself some decades now. What will you regret? What image in there, do you remember that inspired you? Do you still have that? And I start to look and help them look at what their passion is and so forth. And then I say the most important thing is you can do this. That probably the most important mentoring moment is to see their value and to say this is possible. So I'm just talking about my sense of mentoring. What is yours?
Well, I actually would like to keep you going on this because you do mentor so many people, and you mentor, young people, old people, and also prominent business people. And that's something that, that there are a lot of egos. There are a lot of different myths that people create around themselves. How do you pierce that? And how do you bring out the best in them? Because some of the people that I know you work with, and you work with a wide variety of people that have kind of made it, whether it's in entertainment or business, there are a lot of big egos that go with that. One of the things that you do is challenge people so well. But how do you get through to them, and how do you turn them if they're not where they should be?
Well, one of the things, I'm not sure whether I should say I'm sorry to say it or not, because I'm not completely sorry. In Tibetan Buddhist practice, there is a practice for those who are sincere in which you pray for suffering. You say, grant that I will have enough suffering that it will cause me to open the great heart of compassion.
Interesting.
The people that I do work with, and I'll name one who's a mutual friend just because some of it's public. So we did something in Wall Street Journal or whatever, like John Donahoe when he was the CEO of eBay and PayPal. Now he's the CEO of Nike. When he talked to me, he was desperate. There are others who call me, and it's for my industry, that's great. I don't wish it for them, But it's like, okay, it's not business as usual.
Right.
Things are falling apart, or, you know, I have this many billion dollars, my marriage is falling apart,
right,
which I get that as much as anything, or my kids have gone off the rails or something. Help. And that becomes actually a turning point in that person's life. It becomes a gateway mm-hmm. to say, just what we're talking about, it can't be business as usual in some way. I actually have to come to terms with what made my marriage, you know, dissolve and brought the bitterness. And how do I resolve that now with my children? Or I have to figure out, I've been working in a way these 18 hours a week, and nobody's happy.
Right.
So I get the game, you know, when it's halfway through and there's been a lot of injuries.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's right.
And one of the things that I do when I work with people, I listen to the story because we all have our stories, you know, and they're mostly not true, but that's because most stories aren't true. They're only partial, right? But I'm more often want to have people close their eyes and turn inward and say, where do you feel that in your body? What emotions come up? Okay, now stay with it. What memories come? Oh, well, I don't know, I was 12 and my father, you know, stormed out and I never saw him. What stories are associated with it? So we start to explore that way. And then what resources? What's there? What have you learned, you know, when you're about to, you know, feel like you were going to collapse or get enraged? What have you learned? And then I can add a little bit of medicine, but actually the real mentoring is to listen and help them find that they have the medicine. They've just been looking in the wrong place, basically.
You know, it is remarkable, and it's funny, you mentioned John Donahoe, because the way that happened was he saw our Wisdom 2.0 conversation, and he called me up. He said, can you get me in touch with Jack Kornfield? And I said, yeah, I think I can. But you know, Jack, what I think was remarkable, though, is, you know, and all these people, you know, there are big egos involved. I don't mean John, but I mean, I know a lot of the other people you work with, and you know, and it's often, I'm always amazed at your ability to strip that away, at least momentarily, from people.
Suffering does it. It's not me.
Yeah, but most of those people aren't used to admitting that they're wrong or have done anything
right.
wrong, or that it's not their fault, or that, you know, because they are the superhuman, and how could I possibly, you know, be one that's either suffering or causing suffering.
And I think it's in 12 step. Is it called like the gift of desperation or something like that?
Yeah.
It's the first noble truth in Buddhist teachings.
Right, right.
That you have to recognize that there is suffering, not that life is suffering, but that it has it, but that's not the end of the story. If you get stuck there, you get stuck in your reactivity and your fear, but the fact is that that's just the first noble truth. And what it says is, this is the first part of the story, but in fact, there's a path to the end of it. There's a path out of grasping, out of fear, and so forth. You can find an inner dignity and a well-being. It means letting go of some things to become a better human being in some way.
Corporations are not usually beautiful places. And the reason for that is... there are tough decisions that have to be made, and people's lives are impacted. And all you can do is to try and minimize it. And so, for instance, we're changing as a company. You know, we're a 120-year-old company, and, you know, we were built on, you know, the internal combustion engine and the assembly line and all that, and that stood us in good stead for many, many years. Well, then, you know, and I remember my own journey, you know, from when I was growing up as a child, everything was great about the auto industry. People wrote songs about it. You know, the Beach Boys were singing about it, you know, and it was all good. And then, you know, when I got into college and I started to realize that, you know, maybe it wasn't all so good. There was, you know, pollution and, you know, it wasn't called global warming back then, but it was an environmental impact. You know, there were safety issues. There was congestion issues, you know, and it really opened my eyes. And so, anyway, I almost didn't join because of that. And then I thought, no, if I can actually go and make a difference, I'm determined to. But as we're changing now into a very different kind of company with electrification and being less hardware, more software, people's lives are being impacted. And there's no way around that. And I hate that. It's the worst part of the job. But you can't avoid it because part of compassion, I believe, is doing the right thing for the most number of people. But that doesn't mean everybody. And that's the part that, you know, that I think probably never will change in corporations. It's the part I hate. But it is inevitable because change is inevitable, and change is good, actually. But with change comes upheaval, and with upheaval comes some pain for some people. I think, and I've thought about this a lot, you know, is there a better way? And the short answer is, I don't believe there is. I think it's just the way business is. Every business, even the best businesses, have to continue to reinvent themselves, and that will have an impact on people because somebody who was perfect for this model, all of a sudden their skill set doesn't really fit into this new model. And all you can do is to try and be as compassionate and to listen and to try and help them then land on their feet wherever they might go. So it's a never ending thing, and it's tough. It's the hardest part about business, but you can't wish it away. It's there.
You're expressing something very clearly, and there's a lot of pain in it. I also hear you simply talking about leadership, because in lots of other arenas as well, leadership requires making decisions because there's limitations in resource or there are people mm-hmm. not operating the right way and so mm-hmm. forth. Making decisions where some people will be lost or disappointed, even though it's the best decision you can make. So people who are in an inner MBA program, like, you want to be leaders, baby? Get what you're signing up for, because sure. you're not going to sleep well on some nights, and it will tear a little bit at your heart.
It does.
If you're trying to be compassionate, you also have to feel that so that your decision comes from a place of understanding rather than a place of cold economy or something.
And that's what, you know, I think most leaders, if, you know, I'm not big on advice because I think most people have to sort of sort things out for themselves. But, you know, but if I were to give advice to, you know, a group like this, you know, I think it's, you know, you have to have values, you have to have compassion, but you have to make decisions because no decision is a decision. So you can't, and you must move forward in the business. But I would also say this, the mistakes I see most leaders make is that they surround themselves with yes people, they don't know the employees down at the shop floor level, and they don't know their families. I mean, one of the things that I love most about my life is that, you know, I at age 65, I'm still playing ice hockey, but I'm playing in the Ford Hockey League with our employees. And I love that because I get to know employees that I wouldn't get to know otherwise. You know, my kids all played in the little leagues and all the towns we were in, and with our employees at all levels. And you know, you get to know the husbands and the wives and the siblings, and you know. And then though, if something happens and you know those people, yeah, you really feel it. You really feel it because they're not just numbers; they're family members. I mean, you know, in a broader sense. I mean, they're part of your broader family. And so, I cherish that, but it makes it harder too. And I guess the one thing I would also say for last bit of advice is keep your old friends, because the friends that you've known for years, and you don't have to, but the friends that don't want anything from you in business and will tell you when you're being an idiot, they'll tell you, you know, that they think you're absolutely wrong on this, because so many leaders just are in an echo chamber. And it's debilitating, not just for them, but for the whole company.
Their well-being.
Yeah.
So two things. One is a little bit of a non sequitur, but it's about advice because you said, you know, you don't give much advice. When I was in my first clinical class doing PhD, and I had this grizzled old psychologist who ran Gardner State Hospital in Massachusetts, and he'd been a, you know, psychologist therapist forever, and he leaned forward. He said, "You're going to be in a position of responsibility. People are going to look up to you. They will really listen to you. You're going to affect their lives. So you have to be tuned in. You have to really be careful because they respect you. So be careful what you say." So we all are sitting there kind of trembling. And after a little while, he laughs. He says, "But don't worry about it too much, because they really do just what they want and they don't listen to you much at all." And it was very, it was really great to help, you know, say, yes, there's advice. But I think really we learn from each other. We don't learn so much from the words. As you know, as a parent, they're watching you so closely. What I've learned, which is quite relevant to what you're saying, and part of the way that we've changed our teaching, is we mostly do team teaching. And in the early years, I think that it kind of kept us on the straight and narrow, which was a little harder in my 20s and 30s in all kinds of relationships. We'll just leave it. But there's some way in which we learn more from each other than we learn from, you know, the sage on the stage or the top down, what you're talking about, isolation. And I know even in teaching relatively new people, if I pause and there's some dilemma, you know, how do you work with anxiety when all this is happening in the culture and then your kids are sick and you whatever? And, you know, one of the things I'll ask besides checking in is to say, all right, well, what have you learned that helps you? But then I turn to the group and I say, what have you all learned that helps you in this situation? And there is a kind of collective wisdom that comes out that's better than any of us individually could say. And I know that's true in leadership in general. You're describing that. So it's almost, it's like you're missing the boat if you don't have that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, business is hard enough. And if you don't have strong interpersonal relationships in business, then it's so isolating. And frankly, it's no fun. I mean, look, business should be fun too. We're not even talking about fun, but you know, I mean, there's a lot of fun to be had in business, but it's with people. It's not, you know, it's not fun sitting in your office, you know, staring at a spreadsheet. What's fun is to, you know, create cool ideas with your coworkers, to sort of get into the what ifs of the, you know, of the conversations, and then, you know, and getting to know them and getting to know, you know, what makes them tick and all that. I mean, it's just in that, you know, and that you, there's a lot of organic fun that can come of that. And, you know, I think, you know, business is hard. And if you can't have those interpersonal relationships and you can't work as a team, and if you don't have fun, then it's just all going to weigh too much on you. And it probably isn't going to be a happy thing for you. And nobody talks about fun in business, which, you know, and look, I'm in a really tough business. It's a really tough business, and it has been for a long time, and a lot of competitors and lots of change and lots of, you know, low margins and all those things. But it's also, if, you know, I always look to have some fun in my day. And I think everybody should. But it comes from the teams. It doesn't, you individually, it's, you know, it's hard to have a lot of fun.
Yeah. What's the point of your life if there isn't some well-being woven into it? It's right. Not meant to be a grim duty,
yeah,
whether
exactly.
It's work, or some people take meditation as a grim duty. I go to therapy and I work out at the gym and now I'm going to meditate. And it just doesn't make it happy.
Right.
And then it doesn't actually serve you in some deep way. So here's a different question, which has to do with intention. One of the most powerful things in Buddhist psychology is setting intention and then also repeatedly setting intention. So you can be in a difficult conversation or, you know, a difficult stuck place, and you can take a few breaths and ask yourself before you jump in with your answer or try to defend yourself or whatever, you can say, what's my highest intention inside? What's my best intention? And when you ask, at least when I do, if I, for example, might have some little conflict with my beloved wife, Trudy, it could happen. But anyway, before I just try to be right about it, I'll go, what's my best intention? And then I realize, I love her. I want this to work out. I want to express. My whole tone of voice changes in about 5 seconds by remembering that intention. And I remember going into Google in the office of one of their main vice presidents and so forth. And it's all open floor plan, but we were in this little glass room. So the doors were closed, but people around. And I lit a candle to make it, just to create a different space that it wasn't your usual meeting. That's all. It wasn't a big, we didn't make a big Buddhist whatever nonsense out of it. We just lit a candle and took up half a minute to quiet down. And then I asked the group, you know, this was, I don't know, for it was a design or some forward-thinking group, what's your best intention for what we're about to do? People got quiet, and once they set that intention, it raised the bar, it changed the conversation. We weren't just trying to solve a problem or get along. It was like, how do we do something that had an uplift to it in some fashion or other? So I wonder what you know about that in terms of...
I know you've told me to do that, and I have a tough time doing it. Part of our relationship is, I do tend to react before I set my best intention, but I'm working on it.
Yeah. You're the only one in the room that would ever do that, of course.
But you're right. And I think sort of hand in hand comes the notion of empathy, trying to, you know, I always try and take the other person's point of view. And, you know, even if I violently disagree with them, there has to be some good in that point of view, and I try and do that with our other executives or with anybody that, you know, at work that I'm working with, is, you know, why are they doing this? Because the thing I think is really important in business, and this is something that I do say all the time, and I suppose this is the right intention, is you can attack the idea, but don't attack the person. Mm-hmm. And that's very hard to do. I've seen a lot of discussions get very personal very quickly. Mm-hmm. Or if somebody doesn't like the idea, well, that guy's an idiot, or that guy, you know, has terrible intentions, or she doesn't know what she's talking about. And that's wrong. It's the idea, and because if you can't attack the idea, you never get to any honest discussions. But if you do attack the person, then it's over. But I see that in business and probably in life, but certainly in business, you know, over and over and over again. And so I do say all the time to our team, you know, attack the idea, don't attack the person. And I'm marginally successful in getting that concept across. But it's important to get that out there. So that is an intention that I do have. It's hard for, even for me, but I say it all day to myself. And look, there are going to be times where there is somebody you simply don't like, or somebody you simply don't think is coming from the right place. Okay. You know, you can be empathetic as you want, but at the end of the day, you may conclude this person is, you know, not a great person, or, you know, doesn't have the right motivation, or whatever.
It's or okay. Destructive in ways.
Yeah, exactly.
Then it's very, very painful.
Then you deal with it. I don't want to be Pollyanna about it. I mean, you know, it's, but you need to start with that, I believe.
So when you look at leadership outside yourself and look at wise leadership, do you have models? Are there people that you reflect on and say, yeah, this is, I admire, there's a lot to learn. I'm not looking for perfect leadership, because nobody's that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There have been a lot of people that I admire over the years. And frankly, you know, I look to you all the time. But in business, there have been, you know, many people, when I think back, that I've admired, but nobody that I want to emulate. And the reason for that is I think everybody has to have their own path. And I've seen this too, where I've seen at Ford business leaders try and copy another business leader. It's just phony. It doesn't, you know. And I think most people have a great BS detector. I just do. And so employees pick up on that in 2 seconds, that if you're being phony or being someone you're not, so I've never tried to pattern myself after anybody. But I feel like I can get wisdom wherever I can take it. So, I read a lot. I listen a lot. I ask a lot of questions. And I've come across some remarkable people in my life that I value. But I don't hold anybody up as my role model, if you will. And maybe that's odd.
I respect that a lot. There's Warren Buffett. Okay, you're not going to be Warren Buffett.
No, and he has his strengths and I have mine. And
exactly.
If I tried to be him, it wouldn't work.
I was sitting on stage somewhere with a bunch of industry leaders, just for the fun of it, the lamas and mamas and swamis and so forth, all these celebrated. And the thought occurred to me, not the most noble thought, who's more enlightened? Where do I fit in the pecking order? You know, as if that even the word enlightenment is really a confusing word that I don't use much anymore. I'd rather say who's more loving, who's more, you know, compassionate. But and then I realized, I can't be like that one or that one. They may be really good. They're also really weird, but that's another conversation. But I couldn't do that, whether they're more or less or whatever. Exactly what you're saying. I just have to be myself and just be the best that I can.